From the Club Raymond Motor Cars Studio, you're listening to News Radio 1290 WJNO, an iHeartRadio station.
The thoughts and opinions expressed are those of the sponsors and don't necessarily reflect those of this station or iHeartMedia.
This is the Family Center for Recovery show. Join us now to learn ways to begin the path to recovery. The Family Center for Recovery treats patients that most centers don't. Learn more at FCFRMD.com. That's FCFRMD.com.
And here we are. Welcome. Sunday afternoon. You just tuned in to the Family Center for Recovery show. And I'm your host, Peter Nathan. With me today, very special guest, Justin Kunstelman. Good friend of mine. Justin, welcome, and thank you for joining us here in the show in the studio today.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
And I know you're very, very involved. A lot of different task force, and see your name quite often in the Palm Beach Post and in the news, things like that. Could you maybe go over yourself a little, introduce yourself to our listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm the CEO and co-founder of Rebel Recovery Florida. We run an organization that focuses on advocating for users' rights and ensuring that users have access to all of our community programs. And we run a peer recovery support program that focuses on social support and engaging users in accessing all of the community resources that we have available in Palm Beach County. Focusing on naloxone distribution, things like that, trying to find adequate, stable housing, stable employment, ensure they have transportation, food, all their documents that they need. It's pretty much like social re-engagement. So.
Peer recovery. And as far as there was recently JFK, there was a peer support program, and yeah, your thoughts on that? The best I can figure is it seemed like an integral part of is trust, gaining the trust of somebody and treatment and things along those lines. Could you maybe go for our listeners a little bit about the program and your thoughts and things that maybe we takeaways on it and how it went?
Yeah, so the pilot program was based on a Yale study that showed a decrease in recidivism of overdose after buprenorphine, Suboxone, was introduced to individuals who had been brought back from an overdose by naloxone while they were in the hospital. So the hospital would engage the consumer over an 8-hour course with induction into Suboxone. They would be introduced to a peer recovery specialist, which is what our role was. And peer recovery specialist was essentially just to try to add some compassion and understanding to the situation so that the user wasn't immediately getting up and running or that they wouldn't deny access to services based on a police officer showing up or somebody in a uniform, which can just be very off-putting to somebody, especially somebody who's suffered an overdose. And then for the 8 days following, we would show up with fire rescue to give the person their meds. They'd be placed on a taper of Suboxone. And we would show up and try to find out what other social services that we could get them engaged in. What were the surrounding harmful effects of their substance use? If they needed an ID, or if they needed to get into treatment, if they needed a birth certificate, if they needed food stamps, bus pass, adequate housing, whatever it was that we could do to help them, we would engage them in. It was a pretty successful program. It was a 30-person pilot. I believe the last numbers that I saw was 75% at the 8-day mark of no return to overdose, and at the 30-day mark, I believe 62%. So we're still looking at the numbers of the initial pilot study to identify its effectiveness versus no response at all to the overdose. Basically, treat them and street them, which was the hospital's policy before this began. We're hopeful. The numbers look very promising. It's just a matter of getting enough time and data to go through it. We're still in contact with a lot of those individuals on a weekly basis in the peer program. And from there, it kind of blossomed into anybody suffering from any type of substance use issues. We kind of surrounded them and just showed up with compassion and love and care and understanding and saw what we could do to make their situation better. And we've had a lot of really, really great success with that program.
That's a thing that the human element as we talked and as I become more familiar with the program, things such as love, such as compassion and gaining trust. And those were the things I think, you know, I don't really, you know, numbers, okay, there's numbers, but I look as far as just the transformation as far as the lives and the people that you're working with and some of those things. I mean, it must have been very heartwarming and some of the, I guess, probably fostered some relationships as far as along the way and got a true look into somebody's lives and seeing the things as they changed. Your thoughts on things as far as some of the people that you met and some of the changes you saw as they went through this transformation, so to speak.
I mean, it's a peer program, so everybody that we have engaging with consumers in our organization have lived experience with substance use. You know, I know what it's like to be homeless. I've eaten dog food and water like it was cereal. You know, I've ran from the police stealing food from Publix because I was hungry. So, I understand the baseline of where most of these individuals are coming from and so do the peers. So, a lot of it was not in whether or not we could make a positive change in these lives. It was just whether we would get the opportunity to. I don't think there was ever a doubt in anybody's mind that the power of one person who's lived experience engaging with another person in that same position. I don't think anybody's ever questioned that before. You know, but we've seen a lot of really, really quick turnarounds and a lot of quick positive momentum by engaging people with MAT. And there's a lot of negative talk when we first started this about the utilization of medication assisted treatment and treating those with substance use disorder. And what we've seen is incredibly positive changes in a very short amount of time. You know, not everybody is placed on MAT, but those that are have gone from living in cars and parking lots to reengaging with their families, to showing up for work, to having money in their pocket, paying their bills in a matter of weeks. Something that hasn't been accomplished, you know, previously in a matter of years, just leaving it up to them to engage with the current system of community care. So, you know, it's always cool to see individuals out and about when I'm just out in the community that may hear my name or I may say hey to, and they say, oh, you know, I'm in your peer program. I just wanted to thank you and, you know, hug me and tell me how great the peers are. And that's always cool, man. It's not why I do this, but it is an extremely positive perk of the job to see people that, our organization has affected positively, you know.
The program, evidence-based program, were there evidence-based types of therapies involved with it too, or what were some of the things, I guess, that were involved as well with it too?
There were. I didn't know that when I when we started the program. I didn't know that peer recovery support was even a thing. I didn't know that it was an evidence-based practice. Our managing entity did, and they've been really instrumental in helping us get up and going and kind of taking what was just kind of street knowledge. Like, I always knew that users were never going to interact with the police. They were never going to interact positively with law enforcement officials or fire rescue or, you know, people in suits and badges. So when they came to me and said, hey, we want you to start this peer program, they came to me and my program director, Nancy, and said, you know, we want you to start this peer program. I said, what's that? And they said, well, you know, you guys will go out and talk to them and see if you can get them to engage in some of our social services that we have that are available. And I was like, so, yeah, we're just going to go hang out with users. They're like, well, yeah. I'm like, is that a real thing? Like, you guys are going to pay us to do that? And they're like, well, we'll give you money to hire people and, you know, make it a real agency. And I, you know, that was a little off-putting to me. And then as I started doing more research surrounding the use of peers in evidence-based practice and finding out that it goes back probably 25 years to mental health in a hospital system, you know, I started to understand more of the evidence-based practices behind it and to identify that peers have an opportunity to really revolutionize the way that we look at substance use treatment. You know, peers have the ability to move the treatment of substance use disorder from traditional inpatient facilities that are oftentimes inaccessible to most members of our community who need them, and to move that into their homes and to move it into move treatment into the community and meet people really where they're at. So those studies and that kind of overarching mission is kind of what we took up. There's a lot of people who don't believe that that's possible, regardless of any studies that we present them. So it kind of became a challenge for us to say, we can do what you do, and we can do it better, more efficiently, and for less money. So that's kind of the challenge. You know, we kind of stood up to the traditionally accepted treatment industry.
The peer-to-peer program, and that was the thing that really caught me, is that you're there with somebody and you've walked in those same shoes, and that person's looking at you and they're saying, you know what? You know where I'm at. You know what I've been through. You can identify. You know where I'm at. And I don't very often say you know, but in this particular case, yes, you do know. And there's a trust, a barrier that's brought down. Quick thought, and we're going to be going to break, but Justin, your quick thought on something like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no replacement for lived experience. There's a lot of things here in life that are experiential. So lived experience is something that is invaluable in dealing with people with substance use or mental health issues.
And with that, we'll be right back after this short commercial message. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Family Center for Recovery show. Find out more about the Family Center for Recovery on Facebook.com/Family Center for Recovery. The Family Center for Recovery treats patients that most centers don't. We'll be right back.
At the Family Center for Recovery in Lantana, they treat little problems before they become big problems. Unfortunately, 98% of treatment centers won't treat teens because they think it's too difficult or not profitable enough. Whether your teen is struggling with behavior issues, substance abuse, or mental illness, they believe every kid deserves a chance. Contact Family Center for Recovery or go to FCFRMD.com. That's FCFRMD.com. Family Center for Recovery. Before little problems become big problems.
As a teacher, having a foster grandparent in my room, it enables me to have an extra set of hands.
Foster grandparents are role models, tutors, and friends to children with exceptional needs.
It's been fantastic having Grandma Freddie in our room.
It is the best feeling in the world.
I'm a best student because of her.
To learn more about how to become a foster grandparent and help children in need, call 1-800-942-2677 or visit SeniorCorps at nationalservice.gov.
Are you looking for a new career path? Want to make a difference in your community? Become a teacher. The American Board can help you earn a teaching certificate and a Florida teaching license in a year or less. American Board's online program allows you to set your own schedule for a price that fits your budget. Visit www.americanboard.org. That's americanboard.org for more information on how you can become a Florida teacher.
Welcome back to the Family Center for Recovery radio show. If you wish to share this broadcast with a friend, you'll find the link at the Family Center for Recovery's website, fcfrmd.com. That's fcfrmd.com.
And we are back. Thank you for making us part of your Sunday afternoon. You're listening to the Family Center for Recovery show. And I'm your host, Peter Nathan. With me today, very special guest and good friend of mine, Justin Hunzelman. And programs, peer-to-peer, and then there's also syringe exchange program that I'm reading and hearing about. Could you maybe go over a little bit more for our listeners and how that works? I know you've been very instrumental in getting that to our lawmakers and things along those lines. So, Justin, please, for our listeners.
Yeah, so we, you know, probably 2 years ago before the peer program was even kind of an idea, you know, we started out as a harm reduction agency where we were operating an underground syringe exchange and naloxone distribution program. As we moved more towards the peer program, we kind of backed off of the underground syringe exchange, but always having it as a legislative goal for us. We kind of feel like syringe exchange is such a powerful tool in the fight against infectious diseases, and it's an important, an integral part of users' rights, that people are going to use substances to change their mood or their mind, in all aspects of society. There's always going to be, you're never going to legislate away people's need to change the way that they feel, think, or act. It's just a part of our culture as human beings. For as long as human history goes back, we have evidence that people have used substances to change the way that they feel, think, or act. So our thinking behind it as harm reductionists is that we have a responsibility to our fellow humans to ensure that while I may not agree with your actions, I still am able to love you enough to ensure your safety when making those decisions. And that's really what harm reduction is about, and that's really, syringe exchange is really on the forefront of that. When we look at the increased use of opiates and overdoses, what we see is an increased use of IV injection. We look at the increase in injection as a method of use for people who are on opiates or other drugs. And we look at the HIV rate and the hepatitis C rate, the rate of new infection in our communities, and we see a sudden spike starting back when the opiate overdose issue started in Palm Beach County. You know, HIV and hepatitis C rates are skyrocketing now, and we're looking at that as a way to, one, protect members of our community who are not drug users, but also to protect our drug using community, to just ensure that they have sterile equipment to use if they're going to choose to use. So syringe exchange was something that when we first started bringing it up 2 years ago, people were very defensive about it, and everybody told me, you can't do that. We'll never accept that. You can't just, you're just going to help people use drugs. And, my response to them was always to get up in front of a room full of officials and law enforcement and, you know, city and county leaders, and to ask them, you know, we got the same push when we started distributing naloxone, Narcan. Well, people are just going to start using drugs more. So we would just get up and I would just simply ask, you know, I have clean syringes and I have naloxone in my car. Any of you that have never used heroin, would you like to try it? Because I have access to clean syringes and naloxone. Shockingly, nobody did. So we kind of pushed that argument right out the window and kind of showed them the ridiculousness of their thought pattern, that they were just regurgitating nonsense. So as we pushed, we really have always made a push for lawmakers and city and community leaders to accept evidence-based approaches. My big thing has always been, look at the study. If you can't show me peer-reviewed scientific study, it's not true. So we went to State Attorney Ehrenberg, went to Vice Mayor McKinley, and basically presented them the evidence. And I showed them scientific study, decades of evidence that we have on syringe exchanges and naloxone distribution and its effects. And we looked at Dr. Hansel Tooks, who is an amazing advocate for harm reduction, at the Idea Exchange in Miami, and said, look, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We want to bring Dr. Tooks' program to Palm Beach County. I will operate it. And we showed them the evidence. We showed them the studies, and thankfully they finally started listening. I think the first two people to really show an interest in bringing a syringe exchange here, and the first two champions of it outside of me, were really County Mayor Burdick and Vice Mayor McKinley. And then when I sent State Attorney Ehrenberg, I think I sent him like 12 to 14 studies, him and Al Johnson. And the next week I went into the State Attorney Sober Homes Task Force that I sit on, and I saw changes proposed to the state's existing syringe exchange law. And while it hasn't passed yet, you know, they're going to propose it in the next legislative session. So for us, it's a small victory, and all the law allows is for county or municipal funds to be used for syringe exchange access. And it allows for any county that would like to institute a syringe exchange program. So part of our next big push, probably over the next year until the next legislative session, is to try to get this passed so that, you know, we have the ability to operate and to see a reduction in, you know, let's engage in some preventative health care. If people are going to use drugs, the last thing that we need to do is to compound those issues that already exist with new rates of HIV and hepatitis C infection, because that affects our whole community, not just the drug users community. So, you know, the outlook looks pretty positive, and we had a lot of pushback, you know, starting this. People looked at me like I had six heads, but thankfully when presented with evidence, some of our most powerful leaders and the champions of this, you know, listened to a angry street kid and decided to take up this fight and do what I couldn't. So, you know, we're really thankful to them for even proposing the idea, and we'll see what happens.
Excellent. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to the Family Center for Recovery Show. I'm your host, Peter Nathan. You're listening to Justin Kunzelman, and we're talking about the syringe exchange program. And I admire Justin and the way he channels his anger in a very positive manner. And the syringe exchange program. I know that there are other communities in the United States that have utilized, and also there's other countries that have too, and it's backed up by plenty of studies. And this is definitely something that you're listening and you're going to see and hear more about. So we're definitely going to want to get behind making sure we get this passed. Justin, your thoughts as we're talking about peer support and patient rights too. I know you're a very big advocate of that. What are some of your thoughts on patient rights and things along those lines?
Without getting too politically militant, users' rights are not something that has ever been really addressed in South Florida, in the whole state of Florida. We have some great advocates. We have Julia Negron on the West Coast. We have Hansel Tooks and the Idea Exchange folks down in Miami. But users' rights were never really addressed. People who use drugs have always been seen as second class. They've always been seen as people who have a moral failing or people who are not worth somebody fighting for. Back to the DARE program and Nixon era, but what we identify is that current society's thoughts on substance users come from extremely racist policymaking. You look at Henry Anslinger in the 30s when marijuana became illegal because the DEA was going to get defunded. And the easiest way for him to vilify a substance was to say that, people hate Mexicans. Mexicans smoke weed and they're going to rape white women. And that was his basis for passing marijuana criminalization laws. So from there, it just got associated further down the line. We go to Nixon and Nixon, who had two enemies. He had the anti-war left and he had the black community, and black civil rights leaders and the Black Panther Party. And they couldn't disrupt those communities based on their behaviors because freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. So they vilified them by saying, well, the anti-war left smokes weed and the black community does heroin. So we're going to vilify those substances and now we can disrupt their leaders, arrest them, put them in jail. And from there, it's just kind of morphed into a really, well, people who use substances have made a moral choice. They're not worthy of community assistance. They're not worthy of being loved and cared for and compassion and empathy. So I think a lot of that has carried over into the way that we treat substance users. And I think that it's easy for people to deny people their basic human rights simply because they engage in a quote-unquote criminal act. I don't think that's right. I think that everybody has a right to basic human decency and human rights. Everybody has a right to be loved, cared for, and shown empathy.
The Nixon era and the ushering in of the war on drugs and extremely failed policy. And there's some excellent documentaries out there. One of my favorites is The House I Live In. It talks a lot about the things that Justin had just mentioned. And as we were having a cup of coffee the other day, sharing with me that world that he lives in and his thoughts. So we're going to go to a short commercial message. We'll be right back. We'll be talking further with Justin. Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back.
The Family Center for Recovery is the only facility in Florida owned and operated by an addiction psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Moran, and he's dedicated his life to helping the people no one else will. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. The Family Center for Recovery in Lantana is the only treatment center in Florida owned and operated by a triple board certified psychiatrist. This means the Family Center for Recovery does treatment the right way. They treat substance abuse, depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, anxiety, teens and adults at all levels of inpatient care. Check out the innovative, life-changing treatment the Family Center for Recovery in Lantana has to offer at FCFRMD.com. That's FCFRMD.com.
Premature birth is the number one killer of babies. Those who survive often face birth defects and complications that affect them for life. For hundreds of thousands of families in the United States, this is the hardest thing they will ever have to face. And it's even harder on the baby. March of Dimes is providing education and support to families and funding life-saving research to give every baby a fighting chance. You can help. Do something today. Give them tomorrow at marchofdimes.org/tomorrow.
Water. You rely on it daily. But what do you really know about it? There is so much more to H2O than you realize. Did you know that tap water provides us with a low-cost way to stay hydrated? Public health and fire protection, and nearly every product that we use every day. The more you know about your H2O, the more there is to love. To learn more, visit drinktap.org. This message is brought to you by the American Water Works Association and your local water provider.
This is the Family Center for Recovery show. The Family Center for Recovery treats patients that other centers don't, including teens, expectant mothers, patients with mental health issues, or needing a medical detox. Call 855-202-4220.
And we are back. Thank you for making us a part of your Sunday afternoon. You're listening to the Family Center for Recovery show. I'm your host, Peter Nathan. And wherever that may be, if you're out for a Sunday drive, doing some things around the house, we certainly do appreciate you listening to us. With us today in the studio, a very special guest, Justin Kunstelman. We're talking about policy. We're talking about the interesting thing about Nixon, and he understood that actually therapies, treatments, it actually worked. But to get in an effort to get elected, he struck fear. Fear as far as arresting and locking people up. The law and order approach was the way that he decided to take and was kind of the anthem as far as the war on drugs. But we need to kind of change that. We're not going to be able to arrest our way out of this one. Justin, your thoughts as far as where we're at and what we can do to make things differently and where we should be going.
I mean, I think everybody by now has pretty much figured out that criminalizing substance use is an absolute absurd tactic. We look at the harmful effects of marijuana. The most harmful effect of marijuana is contact with law enforcement. Consider that in 2007, 2008, 2009, over 800,000 people a year were locked up due to simple possession of marijuana. Almost a million people a year in the U.S. That's more people. We still arrest more people for simple possession of marijuana than we do for all violent crimes combined. So while I really appreciate police associations and police chiefs and congressmen and senators saying, well, we can't arrest our way out of this problem, we're still trying to. It's still evident we're trying to. I think that it's a very complex issue, and I think that there's a lot of things that really go into it, to solving our substance use issue. One of the things is to move away from trying to solve the substance use issue. I think people are going to use substances for as long as man has crushed grapes. People have used alcohol, marijuana, you know, these are things, ancient Greece to the founding fathers of our country. George Washington had a hemp farm. Like, these are not things that are new. Only in the last 100 years have we started criminalizing these behaviors. And it's all due to money and politics. The elite would have an ability to, dissociate the poor from their families and from normal society and from being able to topple their leadership of government and big business and things like that. And I think you see a lot of big business-backed bad legislation towards criminalizing substance use until medical marijuana and until state-legalized marijuana in Colorado and California. And our nation's capital has recreational marijuana, but it still remains federally illegal. Just the absurdity of it all is, you know, but when we look at when we look at society and we see that there's still a criminalization outside of law enforcement, but it becomes a moral issue in our communities. And I think what we're missing is the root causes of substance use disorder in our communities, which is you know, why are we not looking at treating the causes of childhood trauma? Why are we not looking at treating individuals who are broken and have suffered through homelessness or bad relationships or mental health issues or abuse, emotional, physical, mental abuse? Why are we not looking at treating these individuals with love, compassion, care, and empathy? Why are we still locking them up in cells like they're caged animals? It's baffling to me. You know, coming from somebody who has experience with that, getting locked up because, I think the best example of this is that I was homeless when I was probably 21. I had a buddy that took me in. His name's Sean. I was actually just with him last night. Took me into his house. His mom was in Turkey. His mom came back from Turkey, found out I was staying with him because I didn't have a place to go. All I had was a little S10. Kicked me out. So I parked the S10 in a church behind his house. And such a good friend. He came, left his house to come sleep in the S10 with me, right? And we get woke up at like 3 o'clock in the morning by the police. So knock on the window, and just being treated with absolutely no respect, treated like I'm a common criminal. What crime could I possibly have been committing sleeping? You know, that seems like a situation to me where there was an opportunity to really offer me some services, to say, like, are you sleeping in your truck? Like, I was a kid, you know? But that type of stuff happens every day. And in our community, and as much as we want to say that, like, oh, we're a community that loves our people and we love the members of our community, until we love every member of our community and every member of our community has been offered, at the very least offered, the services that they need to live a fulfilling, joyful, and purposeful life, we cannot say that we love our community. We cannot say that we love the members of our community. And that's really what fighting for users' rights and fighting for access to services is all about, is that, you know, I'm able to use my experience of being profiled and being cast aside and being told that I was nothing and that I was worthless and that I would never be anything and that all I was ever going to do was hurt people, and I was probably just better off killing myself or just being locked up in jail because I was going to die anyways. And I look at the life that I have now and I look at my 2-year-old son and I look at my loving wife and I say, tell them that. Like, can you tell them that I wasn't worth it? Can you look my 2-year-old son in the eye and tell him that his dad wasn't worth saving? And I see these young kids that come into Rebel Recovery every day, and I hear the horror stories about how they're told they're worthless and how they're told they're nothing. And I think, how much different would their life have been if somebody had just approached them with some love and understanding and care and compassion? Maybe giving them a hug every once in a while. You know what I mean? Like, give the kid a dollar and give them a hug. You know, we have this need in our society to try to regulate what people do. I hear all the time from my friends, and probably innocently enough, that, oh, well, I don't give panhandlers money. I'll buy them food if they want food. Well, what business is it of yours what they do with the money that you're offering them? Offer them the help that you can offer them. Let them decide what they do with it. You're not going to change decades of abuse and mental health issues and substance use issues and the trauma and anguish and anxiety and just junk that fills a person up by trying to train them that you need food, not money.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the Family Center for Recovery Show. I'm your host, Peter Nathan. With me, Justin sharing us his thoughts. And if you're listening, you're probably thinking along the lines that I am, that they're very integral, civil rights and human rights. And as a society, I know that we've talked about people in law enforcement and that there are the good ones, the ones that can be over and outshadowed by the ones that are unscrupulous, and so to speak. And that is something that we need. That your thoughts as far as in law enforcement, because you've had a chance with the peer support program to really kind of work with and see some people in law enforcement that are doing good things.
Yeah, I mean, just like with anything, there's good and bad. I think we're at a time in our country where it's a very volatile topic. I think that there is no denying that there's racism and police brutality, and these things have existed long before I was born, and they'll continue to exist, unfortunately, probably long after I'm gone. I have experienced the bad side of law enforcement personally. I've been marginalized and cast aside and thrown in jail for simply having tattoos or the way I look. I still to this day get followed in supermarkets by police officers and security guards, whether I'm with my son or my wife or not. But with Rebel Recovery and the work that we've been doing in the community, I've also had the opportunity to interact with some amazing people in law enforcement. And I by no means is my thoughts anymore like they were when I was young, that all cops are bad. There are some amazing work going on in some of the police departments in our community, and generally the police departments that make up Palm Beach County, including the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, have been extremely progressive in trying to do something to help the members of our community that need it. Are there still some bad individuals? I'm sure. It's a big county, and you'll never be able to weed out bad individuals from getting jobs that they shouldn't have. But I also have started to understand the opposite side of the coin and started to look at, in speaking with some police chiefs and speaking with members of law enforcement, that society has a tendency to dump all of their unwanted issues on law enforcement. So I think part of the solution to this is to identify members of our community who are more equipped to deal with substance use disorder and mental health disorders, and hire them onto the police agencies without being police, so that when 911 is called for these issues, that somebody is showing up and police are not having to deal with things they're not trained to do.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and very apparent is that we ask so much of law enforcement. That, as far as the solution and implementing something like that, it's probably one of the best suggestions I've heard in a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that we have to have somebody that's very well equipped and trained to deal with these things, and law enforcement, unfortunately, is just not.
We will be right back after this short commercial message. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back in a jiff.
Like the Family Center for Recovery on Facebook to learn more about their mental health service and Addiction Resources Center. Located in Lantana, Florida, the Family Center for Recovery treats patients that most centers can't. Call anytime, 855-202-4220. We'll be right back.
At the Family Center for Recovery in Lantana, they treat little problems before they become big problems. Unfortunately, 98% of treatment centers won't treat teens because they think it's too difficult or not profitable enough. Whether your teen is struggling with behavior issues, substance abuse, or mental illness, they believe every kid deserves a chance. Contact Family Center for Recovery or go to FCFRMD.com. That's FCFRMD.com. Family Center for Recovery. Before little problems become big problems.
Are you looking for a new career path? Want to make a difference in your community? Become a teacher. The American Board can help you earn a teaching certificate and a Florida teaching license in a year or less. American Board's online program allows you to set your own schedule for a price that fits your budget. Visit www.americanboard.org. That's americanboard.org for more information on how you can become a Florida teacher.
As a teacher, having a foster grandparent in my room, it enables me to have an extra set of hands.
Foster grandparents are role models, tutors, and friends to children with exceptional needs.
It's been fantastic having Grandma Freddie in our room.
It is the best feeling in the world.
I'm a bad student because of her.
To learn more about how to become a foster grandparent and help children in need, call 1-800-942-2677 or visit SeniorCorps at nationalservice.gov.
This is the Family Center for Recovery show. The Family Center for Recovery treats patients that other centers don't, including teens, expectant mothers, patients with mental health issues, or needing a medical detox. Call 855-202-4220.
Thank you for making us a part of your Sunday afternoon. You're listening to the Family Center for Recovery show. With me today, very special guest in the studio, Justin Kunzelman. Justin, your thoughts as far as we get ready to kind of wrap up in this last segment?
I know I have a very militant mindset as far as this kind of stuff goes, and it's just something that I'm passionate about, and like I said, it's my experience. You know, these are things that I've experienced firsthand. I didn't learn these in a textbook. I didn't go to college to understand how to treat drug users. I always try to impart to people, and they say, well, what can I do? I should be nice. Just be nice to drug users. Like, they're not terrible people. You know, we push this mythology, especially in the treatment field, that all drug users lie, all drug users steal, if I hear one more time somebody tell me, well, he's an addict, so what do you expect? I'm going to lose my mind. You know, politicians lie, politicians steal, big business has built their entire companies on lying and stealing, but addicts are the ones that we don't trust. I don't buy that. I don't accept that as an accepted stereotype, and I think people oftentimes forget that it's a stereotype, and the worst thing is that it's usually people that are in recovery, that have experienced substance use issues themselves, who have been told that for so long that they start to accept it and perpetuate it onto their brothers and sisters. I just want people to be nice to users. I want them to understand that if you can't accept what we go through on an experiential nature, trust me when I say that we're not all bad people. You know, we're fathers and mothers and sons and daughters, and we're still people at the end of the day. And, you know, things hurt our feelings and things, you know, we're susceptible to trauma and hurt and pain and passion and love and understanding and joy, just like anybody else.
Yeah, the thing that I've gathered as in my quest and the science behind it, and recognizing that addiction is a disease. It's very similar to, as far as along the lines of diabetics or somebody that cancer, that the stigma associated with addiction, and really kind of looking behind the science and the brain and things that are involved, and being more compassionate, really the understanding of and the treatment is such. So your thoughts, Justin, as we talk.
Yeah, I think that there is a standardized, accepted culture of what is right, quote unquote, in treatment of substance use disorders. The problem with it is that a lot of the accepted standards for what, quote unquote, typical behaviors of substance users are, or typical outcomes of substance users in this type of treatment or this type of treatment, nobody can ever present me with studies that show scientific fact. And one thing I've learned is that if you can't show me peer-reviewed scientific study, it's not a fact. It's a hypothesis, right? I believe in I know that gravity exists because of peer-reviewed scientific study. If Einstein needed scientific peer-reviewed study to prove the theory of relativity, and he was not just accepted at his word, then I can't accept Joe Schmo at his word that he knows what's best for all people who suffer from substance use disorder or mental health. I want to see us start to question, where is the study? Show me the scientific evidence that proves that the methods we are using in our communities are effective. And that's what I've really tried to push, is that, do I believe that syringe exchange works? Yes. Do I believe harm reduction works? Yes. Do I believe that medical marijuana could prove as a safer alternative to opioid pain medication? Yes. Do I present that as fact before reading study? Absolutely not. I question myself and my own beliefs, and I seek out study, and I seek out, and I'm forced to accept the facts. Just so happens that the things that I believe up until now have all been proven in peer-reviewed study, and I've been able to present those facts to leaders in our community. Presenting Dave Ehrenberg and Hal Johnson and Melissa McKinley with studies, scientific studies from decades of evidence that we have on syringe exchanges. These are not things that I'm trying to push just to get them passed because I think it's a good idea. I have study that shows that these things are effective, that they will have a positive effect on our community. And I think we need to question more of what is accepted fact, especially in an age where we have access to the internet and where we just digest anything that comes across as accepted fact, and we have these non-proven facts that are just recirculated, you know?
Yeah, that's an excellent point as far as peer-reviewed and studies, and that's something I know that I've addressed, and we talked with prior guests, I think Vice Mayor Melissa McKinley, we were talking with about scripts, Bill Nelson, and things as far as what we need to do more of. We're getting ready to wrap up here, and I really appreciate you joining us here, Justin, and sharing your views and your thoughts and your final thought before we call it a day here.
Just be nice to drug users. You know, we're people, and you know, always remember that there's a law higher than the law of government, and that's the law of conscience.
And with that, have an excellent week. We'll look forward to you joining us again next week for the Family Center Recovery Show. Thanks again, Justin. We greatly appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay.
This has been the Family Center for Recovery Radio Show. To learn more about the center or to send a link of the show, visit FCFRMD.com. That's FCFRMD.com. Join us next Sunday at noon for the Family Center for Recovery Show.
Tablets is all it takes to make your thin hair feel and look thicker and fuller. Guaranteed. Viviscal is the number one drug-free hair growth supplement in the U.S., with one box being sold every minute globally. It's clinically researched to promote existing hair growth for men and women, and now a 90-day supply of Viviscal is offered in your area risk-free, plus free shipping. Call 800-340-4214. Viviscal nourishes thinning hair from within. You'll love your hair growth results, guaranteed. Indeed. Viviscal is so effective, it's recommended by top doctors. Here's Dr. John Laura.
As a dermatologist, I feel confident recommending Viviscal. It's backed by 25 years of research and multiple clinical studies that demonstrate Viviscal's effectiveness in promoting the growth of thicker, fuller hair.
Want to try Viviscal? Every listener that calls now gets a 90-day risk-free supply plus free shipping. Call now, 800-340-4214. 800-340-4214. That's 800-340-4214.
Being a foster grandparent has definitely given me a purpose in life.
Thank you, Grandma.
To learn more about how to become a foster grandparent and help children in need, call 1-800-942-2677 or visit SeniorCorps at nationalservice.gov.
News Radio 1290, WJNO. What's next?
It was a fake reveal.
Happens here.
We will get other chances.
News Radio 1290, WJNO, West Palm Beach.
I will be going down to Puerto Rico next week.